Live Like You Gotta Live, Chuck Berry, 1969. I positioned myself beside the empty chair, said a little prayer, and dropped. I leaned left, as always, to spare my bad hip. I didn't land quite square, but I grabbed the wooden arms, pushed with my strong foot, and the chair only teetered. A month before, I would have spilled, but I was stronger now. I could imagine Kathy Green applauding. "Good job, Edgar," he said. "Or are you an Eddie?" "Pick your poison," I answered either. "What might you have in that pitcher?" "Iced green tea," he said. "Very cooling. Try some?" "I'd love to." He poured me a glass, then topped up his own and raised it. The tea was only faintly green. His eyes, caught in fine nets of wrinkles, were greener. His hair was black, streaking in white at the temples, and quite long indeed. When the wind lifted it, I could see a scar at the top of his hairline on the right side, coin-shaped but smaller. He was wearing a bathing suit today, and his legs were as brown as his arms. He looked fit, but I thought he also looked tired. "Let's drink to you, muchacho. You made it." "All right," I said. "To me." We clinked glasses and drank. I'd had green tea before and thought it was okay, but this was heavenly, like drinking cold silk with just a faint tang of sweetness. "Do you taste the honey?" he asked, and smiled when I nodded. "Not everyone does. I just put in a tablespoonful per pitcher. It releases the natural sweetness of the tea. I learned that cooking on a tramp steamer in the China Sea." He held up his glass and squinted through it. "We fought off many pirates and mated with strange and dusky women neath tropic skies." "That sounds a trifle bullshitty to me, Mr. Wireman," he laughed. "I actually read about the honey thing in one of Miss Eastlake's cookery books." "Is she the lady you come out with in the mornings, the one in the wheelchair?" "Indeed she is." And without thinking much about what I was saying, it was her enormous blue sneakers propped up on the chrome footrests of her wheelchair I was thinking about. I said, "The Bride of the Godfather." Wireman gaped, those green eyes of his so wide I was about to apologize for my faux pas. Then he really began to laugh. It was the kind of balls-to-the-wall bellowing you give out on those rare occasions when something sneaks past all your defenses and gets to the sweet spot of your funny bone. I mean, the man was busting a gut. And when he saw I didn't have the slightest idea what had gotten him, he laughed even harder, his not inconsiderable belly heaving. He tried to put his glass back on the little table and missed. The glass plummeted straight down to the sand and stuck there, perfectly upright, like a cigarette butt in one of those urns of sand you used to see beside the elevators in hotel lobbies. That struck him even funnier, and he pointed at it. "I couldn't have done that if I was trying," he managed, and then was off again, gale upon gale, heaving in his chair, one hand clutching his stomach, the other planted on his chest. A snatch of poetry read in high school, over 30 years before, suddenly came back to me with haunting clarity. "Men do not sham convulsion, nor simulate a throw." I was smiling myself, smiling and chuckling, because that kind of hilarity is catching, even when you don't know what the joke is. And the glass falling that way, with every drop of Wireman's tea staying inside, that was funny, like a gag in a Roadrunner cartoon. But the plummeting glass hadn't been the source of Wireman's hilarity. "I don't get it. I mean, I'm sorry if I..." "She sort of is," Wireman cried, cackling so crazily he was almost incoherent. "She sort of is, that's the thing. Only it's daughter, of course. She's the daughter of the Godfather." But he had been rocking from side to side, as well as up and down. No sham, authentic throw. And that was when his beach chair finally gave up the ghost with a loud crack, first snapping him forward with an extremely comical look of surprise on his face, and then spilling him onto the sand. One of his flailing arms caught the post of the umbrella and upended the table. A gust of wind caught the umbrella, puffed it like a sail, and began to drag the table down the beach. What got me laughing wasn't the bug-eyed look of amazement on Wireman's face when his disintegrating beach chair tried to clamp on him like a striped jaw, nor his sudden barrel roll onto the sand. It wasn't even the sight of that table trying to escape, tugged by its own umbrella. It was Wireman's glass, still standing placidly upright between the sprawling man's side and left arm. Acme Iced Tea Company, I thought, still stuck on those old Roadrunner cartoons. Meep, meep. And that, of course, made me think of the crane that had done the damage, the one with the fucked-up beeper that hadn't beeped, and all at once I saw myself as Wile E. Coyote in the cab of my disintegrating pickup truck, eyes bugged in bewilderment, frazzled ears sticking off in two opposite directions, and maybe smoking a little at the tips. That did it. I laughed until I rolled bonelessly out of my own chair and plopped onto the sand beside Wireman. But I also missed the glass, which stood perfectly upright like a cigarette butt in an urn of sand. It was impossible for me to laugh any harder, but I did. Tears gushed down my cheeks, and the world had begun to dim out as my brain went into oxygen deprivation mode. Wireman, still howling, went crawling after his runaway table, locomoting on knees and elbows. He made a grab for the base, and it skittered away as if sensing his approach. Wireman plowed face first into the sand and came up laughing and sneezing. I rolled over on my back and gasped for breath, on the verge of passing out but still laughing. That was how I met Wireman. 3. 20 minutes later, the table had been placed in a rough approximation of its original position. That was all very well, but neither of us could look at the umbrella without breaking into fits of the giggles. One of its pie wedges was torn, and now rose crookedly from the table, giving it the look of a drunken man trying to pretend he's sober. Wireman had moved the remaining chair down to the end of the wooden walk, and had taken it at my insistence. I was sitting on the walk itself, which, although backless, would make getting up an easier, not to mention more dignified, proposition. Wireman had offered to replace the spilled pitcher of iced tea with a fresh one. I refused this, but agreed to split the miraculously unspilled glass with him. "Now we're water brothers," he said when it was gone. "Is that some Indian ritual?" I asked. "Nope. From Stranger in a Strange Land, by Robert Heinlein, bless his memory." It occurred to me that I'd never seen him reading as he sat in his striped chair, but I didn't mention it. Lots of people don't read on the beach. The glare gives them headaches. I sympathized with people who got headaches. He began to laugh again. He covered his mouth with both hands like a child, but the laughter burst through. "No more, Jesus, no more. I feel like I sprung every muscle in my stomach." "Me too," I said. For a moment we said nothing more. The breeze off the gulf was cool and fresh that day, with a rueful salt tang. The rip in the umbrella flapped. The dark spot on the sand where the iced tea pitcher had spilled was already almost dry. He snickered. "Did you see the table trying to escape? The fucking table?" I also snickered. My hip hurt and my stomach muscles ached, but I felt pretty good for a man who had almost laughed himself unconscious. "Alabama getaway," I said. He nodded, still wiping sand from his face. "Grateful Dead, 1979, or thereabouts." He giggled. The giggle broadened into a chuckle, and the chuckle became another bellow of full-throated laughter. He held his belly and groaned. "I can't. I have to stop, but Bride of the Godfather, Jesus!" And he was off again. "Don't you ever tell her I said that," I said. He quit laughing, but not smiling. "I ain't that indiscreet, muchacho. But it was the hat, right? That big straw hat she wears? Like Marlon Brando in the garden playing with the little kid?" It had actually been as much the sneakers, but I nodded and we laughed some more. "If we crack up when I introduce you," he said, cracking up again, probably at the idea of cracking up, it goes that way when the fit is on you, "we're going to say it's because I broke my chair, right?"
"Right," I said.
"What did you mean when you said she sort of is?"
"You really don't know?"
"No clue." He pointed at Big Pink, which was looking very small in the distance, looking like a long walk back. "Who do you think owns your place, amigo? I mean, I'm sure you pay a real estate agent, or Vacation Homes Be Us, but where do you think the balance of your check finally ends up?"
"I'm going to guess in Miss Eastlake's bank account."
"Correct. Miss Elizabeth Eastlake. Given the lady's age, 85, I guess you could call her Old Miss." He began laughing again, shook his head and said, "I have to stop. But in fairness to myself, it's been a long time since I had anything to belly laugh about."
"Same here."
He looked at me, armless, all patchy-haired on one side, and nodded. Then for a little while we just looked out at the gulf. I know that people come to Florida when they're old and sick because it's warm pretty much year-round, but I think the Gulf of Mexico has something else going for it. Just looking into that mild, flat, sunlit calm is healing. It's a big word, isn't it? Gulf, I mean. Big enough to drop a lot of things into it and watch them disappear. After a while, Wireman said, "And who do you think owns the houses between your place and this one?" He jerked his thumb over his shoulder at the white walls and orange tile. Which, by the way, is listed on the county plat maps as Heron's Roost, and I call El Palacio de Asesinos. Would that also be Miss Eastlake? "You're two for two," he said. "Why do you call it Palace of Assassins?" "Well, it's Outlaw Hideout, when I think in English," Wireman said with an apologetic smile, "because it looks like the place where the head bad guy in a Sam Peckinpah Western would hang his hat. Anyway, you've got six rather nice homes between Heron's Roost and Salmon Point." "Which I call Big Pink," I said, "when I think in English." He nodded. "El Rosado Grande. Good name, I like it. You'll be there how long?" "I have the place for a year, but honestly, I don't know. I'm not afraid of hot weather. I guess they call it the mean season. But there's hurricanes to consider." "Yep, down here we all consider hurricane season. Especially since Charlie and Katrina. But the houses between Salmon Point and Heron's Roost will be empty long before hurricane season. Like the rest of Duma Key. Which could as easily have been called East Lake Island, by the way." "Are you saying this is all hers?" "That's complicated even for a guy like me, who was a lawyer in his other life," Wireman said. "Once upon a time her father owned it all, along with a good swatch of the Florida mainland east of here. He sold everything in the 30s except for Duma. Miss Eastlake does own the north end. Of that there is no doubt." Wireman waved his arm to indicate the northern tip of the island, the part he would later characterize as being as bald as a stripper's pussy. "The land and the houses on it, from Heron's Roost, the most luxurious, to your Big Pink, the most adventurous. They bring her an income she hardly needs, because her father also left her and her siblings mucho dinero." "How many of her brothers and sisters are still—" "None," Wireman said. "The daughter of the godfather is the last." He snorted and shook his head. "I have to quit calling her that," he said, more to himself than to me. "If you say so. What I really wonder about is why the rest of the island isn't developed. Given the never-ending housing and building boom in Florida, that seemed insane to me from the first day I crossed the bridge." "You speak like a man with specialized knowledge. What are you in your other life, Edgar?" "A building contractor." "And those days are behind you now?" I could have hedged. I didn't know him well enough to put myself on the line, but I didn't. I'm sure our mutual fit of hysterics had a lot to do with that. "Yes," I said. "And what are you in this life?" I sighed and looked away from him. "Out at the Gulf, where you could put all your old miseries and watch them disappear without a trace. Can't tell yet for sure. I've been doing some painting." And waited for him to laugh. He didn't. "You wouldn't be the first painter to stay at Big Pink. It has quite an artistic history." "You're kidding." There was nothing in the house to suggest such a thing. "Oh, yes," he said. "Alexander Calder stayed there. Keith Haring. Marcel Duchamp. All back before beach erosion put the place in danger of falling into the water." He paused. "Salvador Dali?" "No shucking way," I cried, then flushed when he cocked his head. For a moment I felt all the old frustrated rage rush in, seeming to clog my head and throat. "I can do this," I thought. "Sorry, I had an accident a while back, and then I stopped." "Not hard to figure that one out," Wireman said. "In case you didn't notice, you're short a gizmo on the right side, muchacho." "Yes, and sometimes I get, I don't know, aphasic, I guess." "Uh-huh. In any case, I tell no lie about Dali. He stayed in your house for 3 weeks in 1981. Then, with hardly a pause, "I know what you're going through." "I seriously doubt that." I didn't mean to sound harsh, but that was how it sounded. That was how I felt, actually. Wireman said nothing for a little while. The torn umbrella flapped. I had time to think, well, this was a potentially interesting friendship that's not going to happen. But when he next spoke, his voice was calm and pleasant. It was as if our little side trip had never occurred. Part of Duma's development problem is simple overgrowth. The sea oats belong, but the rest of that shit has no business growing without irrigation. Somebody better investigate. That's what I think. My daughter and I went exploring one day. It looked like outright jungle south of here. Wireman looked alarmed. Duma Key Road's no excursion for a guy in your condition. It's in shit shape. Tell me about it. What I want to know is how come it isn't four lanes wide with bike paths on both sides and condos every 800 yards? Because no one knows who owns the land. How about that for a start? You serious? Yep. Miss Eastlake has owned from the tip of the island south to Heron's Roost free and clear since 1950. About that, there is absolutely no doubt. It was in the wills. Wills? Plural? Three of them. All holographic, all witnessed by different people, all different when it comes to Duma Key. All of them, however, make the north end of Duma a no-strings bequest to Elizabeth Eastlake from her father John. The rest has been in courts ever since. 60 years of squabbling that makes Bleak House look like Dick and Jane. I thought you said all Miss Eastlake's siblings were dead. They are, but she has nieces and nephews and grandnieces and grandnephews. Like Sherwin-Williams paint, they cover the earth. They're the ones doing the squabbling. But they squabble with each other, not her. Her only mention in the old man's multiple wills had to do with this piece of Duma Key, which was carefully marked off by two surveying companies, one just before World War II and one just after. This is all a matter of public record. And do you know what, amigo? I shook my head. Miss Eastlake thinks that's exactly what her old man wanted to happen. And having cast my lawyerly eye over the copies of the wills, so do I. Who pays the taxes? He looked surprised, then laughed. I enjoy you more and more, Bato. My other life, I reminded him. I was already liking the sound of that other life thing. Right. Then you'll appreciate this, he said. It's clever. All three of John Eastlake's last wills and testaments contained identical clauses setting up a trust fund to pay the taxes. The original investment company administering the trust has been absorbed since then. In fact, the absorbing company has been absorbed. It's the way America does business, I said. It is indeed. In any case, the fund has never been in danger of going broke, and the taxes are paid like clockwork every year. Money talks, bullshit walks. It's the truth. He stood up, put his hands in the small of his back, and twisted it. Would you like to come up to the house and meet the boss? She should be arising from her nap just about now. She has her problems, but even at 85, she's quite the babe. This wasn't the time to tell him I thought I had already met her, briefly, courtesy of my answering machine. Another day, when the hilarity subsides. He nodded. Walk down tomorrow afternoon, if you like. Maybe I will. It's been real. I held out my hand again. He shook it again, looking at the stump of my right arm as he did so. No prosthesis, or do you just leave it off when you're not among the hoi polloi? I had a story I told people about that, nerve pain in the stump, but it was a lie, and I didn't want to lie to Wireman. Partly because he had a nose attuned to the delicate smell of bullshit, but mostly because I just didn't want to lie to him. And I was measured for one while I was still in the hospital, of course. And I got the hard sell on it from just about everyone, especially my physical therapist and this psychologist friend of mine. They said the quicker I learned to use it, the quicker I'd be able to get on with my life. Just put the whole thing behind you and go on dancing. Yes. Only sometimes putting a thing behind you isn't so easy to do. No. Sometimes it's not even right, Wireman said. That isn't it exactly, but it's... I trailed off and seesawed my hand in the air. Close enough for rock and roll? Yes, I said. Thanks for the cold drink. Come on back and get another one. I only take the sun between 2 and 3. An hour a day is enough for me. But Miss Eastlake either sleeps or rearranges her china figurines most of the afternoon. And, of course, she never misses Oprah, so I have time. More than I know what to do with, actually. Who knows? We might find a lot to talk about.
All right, I said. Sounds good.
Wireman grinned. It made him handsome. He offered his hand, and I shook with him again. You know what I think? Friendships founded on laughter are always fortuitous.
Maybe your next job will be writing the fortunes in Chinese cookies, I said.
There could be worse jobs, muchacho. Far worse.
Four.
Walking back, my thoughts turned to Miss Eastlake, an old lady in big blue sneakers and a wide straw hat who just happened to own, sort of, her own Florida key. Not the bride of the Godfather after all, but daughter of the land baron and, apparently, patroness of the arts. My mind had done another of those weird slipsides, and I couldn't remember her father's name, something simple, only one syllable. But I remembered the basic situation as Wireman had outlined it. I'd never heard of anything similar, and when you build for a living, you see all sorts of strange property arrangements. I thought it was actually rather ingenious, if, that was, you wanted to keep most of your little kingdom in a state of undeveloped grace. The question was, why? I was most of the way back to Big Pink before I realized my leg was aching like a bastard. I limped inside, slurped water directly from the kitchen tap, then made my way across the living room to the main bedroom. I saw the light on the answering machine was blinking, but I wanted nothing to do with messages from the outside world right then. All I wanted was to get off my feet. I lay down and looked at the slowly revolving blades of the overhead fan. I hadn't done very well explaining my lack of a fake arm. I wondered if Wireman would have had better luck with what's a lawyer doing as a rich old spinster's houseman. What kind of other life is that? Still considering this, I drifted off into a dreamless and very satisfying nap.
5.
When I woke up, I took a hot shower, then went into the living room to check my answering machine. I wasn't as stiff as I expected, given my 2-mile walk. I might get up tomorrow hobbling, but for tonight I thought I was going to be all right. The message was from Jack. He said his mother had connected him with someone named Dario Nannuzzi. Nannuzzi would be happy to look at my pictures between 4 and 5 p.m. on Friday afternoon. Could I bring no more than 10 of those I considered best to the Scotto Gallery? No sketches. Nannuzzi only wanted to see finished work. I felt a tickle of unease at this. No, that's not even close to what I felt. My stomach cramped, and I could have sworn my bowels dropped 3 inches. Nor was that the worst. That half-itch, half-pain swarmed up my right side and down the arm that was no longer there. I told myself such feelings, which amounted to 3 days in advance flop sweat, were stupid. I had once made a $10 million pitch to the St. Paul City Council, after all, which at that time had included a man who'd gone on to become the governor of Minnesota. I'd seen 2 girls through first dance recitals, cheerleading tryouts, driving lessons, and the hell of adolescence. What was showing some of my paintings to an art gallery guy compared to that? Nevertheless, I made my way up the stairs to Little Pink with leaden heels. The sun was going down, flooding the big room with gorgeous and improbable tangerine light, but I felt no urge to try and capture it, not this evening. The light called to me just the same, as the photograph of some long-gone love happened on by accident while going through an old box of souvenirs may call to you. And the tide was in. Even upstairs I could hear the grinding voice of the shells. I sat down and began poking at the clutter of items on my junk table, a feather, a water-smoothed stone, a disposable lighter rinsed to an anonymous gray. Now, it wasn't Emily Dickinson I thought of, but some old folk song. Don't the sun look good, Mama, shining through the trees. No trees out there, of course, but I could put one on the horizon if I wanted to. I could put one out there for the red sunset to shine through. Hello, Dolly. I wasn't afraid of being told I had no talent. I was afraid of Signor Nannuzzi telling me I had a little talent, of having him hold his thumb and forefinger maybe 1/4 inch apart and advising me to reserve a space at the Venice Sidewalk Art Festival, that I would certainly find success there. Many tourists would surely be taken by my charming Dali imitations.
And if he did that, held his thumb and forefinger a quarter of an inch apart, and said, "Lidl," what did I do then? Could some stranger's verdict take away my new confidence in myself? Steal my peculiar new joy? "Maybe," I said.
Yes, because painting pictures wasn't like putting up shopping malls. The easiest thing would be just to cancel the appointment. Except I'd sort of promised Ilsa, and I wasn't in the habit of breaking the promises I made to my children. My right arm was still itching almost hard enough to hurt, but I barely noticed. There were 8 or 9 canvases lined up against the wall to my left. I turned toward them thinking I'd try to decide which ones were best, but I never so much as looked at them. Tom Riley was standing at the head of the stairs. He was naked except for a pair of light blue pajama pants, darker at the crotch and down the inside of one leg, where he had wet them. His right eye was gone. There was a matted socket full of red and black gore where it had been. Dried blood streaked back along his right temple like war paint, disappearing into graying hair above his ear. His other eye stared out at the Gulf of Mexico. Carnival sunset swam over his narrow, pallid face. I shrieked in surprise and terror, recoiled, and fell off my chair. I landed on my bad hip and yelled out again, this time from pain. I jerked and my foot struck the chair I'd been sitting in, knocking it over. When I looked toward the stairs again, Tom was gone.
6. 10 minutes later, I was downstairs dialing his home number. I descended the stairs from Little Pink in the sitting position, thumping down one riser at a time on my ass. Not because I'd hurt my hip falling off the chair, but because my legs were trembling so badly I didn't trust myself on my feet. I was afraid I might take a header, even going down backward so I could clutch the banister with my left hand. Hell, I was afraid I might faint. I kept remembering the day at Lake Phelan I'd turned to see Tom with that unnatural shine in his eyes. Tom trying not to embarrass me by actual bawling. "Boss, I can't get used to seeing you this way. I'm so sorry." The telephone began to ring in Tom's nice Apple Valley home. Tom, who'd been married and divorced twice. Tom, who had advised me against moving out of the house in Mendota Heights.
"It's like giving up home field advantage in a playoff game," he'd said.
Tom, who'd gone on to enjoy my home field quite a little bit himself, if friends with benefits were to be believed. And I did believe it. I believed what I'd seen upstairs, too. One ring, 2, 3. "Come on," I muttered. "Pick the motherfucker up." I didn't know what I'd say if he did, and I didn't care. All I wanted right then was to hear his voice. I did, but on a recording.
"Hi, you've reached Tom Riley," he said. "My brother George and I are off with our mother on our annual cruise. It's Nassau this year. What do you say, mother?" "That I'm a Bahama mama," said a cigarette-cracked but undeniably cheerful voice.
"That's right, she is," Tom resumed.
"We'll be back February 8th. In the meantime, you can leave a message."
"When, George?"
"At the Zound of the Zeep," cried a male voice.
"Right," Tom agreed. "Zound of the Zeep. Or you can call my office."
He gave the number, and then all three of them said,
"Bon voyage!"
I hung up without saying anything. It hadn't sounded like the outgoing message of a man contemplating suicide, but of course he had been with his nearest and dearest, the ones who later on were most apt to say, "He seemed fine," and, "Who says it's going to be suicide?" I asked the empty room, and then looked around fearfully to make sure it was empty. "Who says it might not be an accident, or even murder, assuming it hasn't happened already?" But if it had already happened, someone would probably have called me, maybe Bosie, but most likely Pam. Also, it's suicide. This time telling the room, "It's suicide, and it hasn't happened yet." That was a warning. I got up and crutched into the bedroom. I'd been using the crutch less lately, but I wanted it tonight. Indeed, I did. My best girl was propped against the pillows on the side of the bed that would have belonged to a real woman, if I'd still had one. I sat down, picked her up, and looked into those big blue peepers, so full of cartoon surprise. "Oh, you nasty man," my Reba, who looked like Lucy Ricardo. It was like Scrooge getting visited by the ghost of Christmas yet to come, I told her. "These are things that may be." Reba offered no opinion on this idea. "But what do I do?" That wasn't like the paintings. That wasn't like the paintings at all. But it was, and I knew it. Both paintings and visions originated in the human brain, and something in my brain had changed. I thought the change had come about as a result of just the right combination of injuries, or the wrong one. Contre coup, Broca's area, and Duma key. The key was, what? "Amplifying it," I told Reba, "isn't it?" She offered no opinion. "There's something here, and it's acting on me. Is it possible it even called me?" The notion made me break out in goose flesh. Beneath me, the shells ground together as the waves lifted them and dropped them. It was all too easy to imagine skulls instead of shells, thousands of them, all gnashing their teeth at once when the waves came in. Was it Jack who had said there was another house somewhere up there in the Tulies, falling apart? I thought so. When Ilsa and I tried to drive that way, the road had gone bad in a hurry. So had Ilsa's stomach. My own gut had been okay, but the stink of the encroaching flora had been nasty and the itch in my missing arm had been worse. Wireman had looked alarmed when I told him about our attempted exploration. "Duma Key Road's no excursion for a guy in your condition," he'd said. The question was, exactly what was my condition? Reba went on, offering no opinion. "I don't want this to be happening," I said softly. Reba only stared up at me. I was a nasty man, that was her opinion. "What good are you?" I asked and threw her aside. She landed face down on her pillow with her bottom up and her pink cotton legs spread, looking quite a little slut. "Oh, you nasty man indeed." I dropped my head, looked at the carpet between my knees, and rubbed the nape of my neck. The muscles there were tight and knotted. They felt like iron. I hadn't had one of my bad headaches in a while, but if those muscles didn't loosen soon, I'd be having a whopper tonight. I needed to eat something. That would be a start. Something comforting. One of those calorie-stuffed frozen dinners sounded about right. The kind where you slice the wrapping over the frozen meat and gravy, blast it for 7 minutes in the microwave, and then chow down like a motherfucker. But I sat still a while longer. I had many questions, and most were probably beyond my ability to answer. I recognized that and accepted it. I had learned to accept a lot since the day I'd had my confrontation with the crane, but I thought I had to try for at least one answer before I could bring myself to eat, hungry as I was. The phone on the bed table had come with the house. It was charmingly old-fashioned, the princess model with a rotary dial. It sat on a directory that was mostly yellow pages. I turned to the skinny white section, thinking I wouldn't find Elizabeth Eastlake listed, but I did. I dialed the number. It rang twice, and then Wireman answered. "Hello, Eastlake residence." There was hardly a trace in that perfectly modulated voice of the man who had laughed hard enough to break his chair. And all at once this seemed like the world's worst idea, but I saw no other option. "Wireman, this is Edgar Fremantle. I need help." Six. The Lady of the House. One. The following afternoon found me once more sitting at the little table at the end of the El Palacio de Asesinos boardwalk. The striped umbrella, although ripped, was still serviceable. A breeze chilly enough to warm sweatshirts was blowing in off the water. Little scars of light danced across the tabletop as I talked, and I talked all right, for almost an hour, refreshing myself with sips of green tea from a glass Wireman kept filled. At last I stopped, and for a little while there was no sound but the mild whisper of the incoming waves, breaking and running up the strand. Wireman must have heard enough wrong in my voice the night before to concern him, because he'd offered to come in the Palacio's golf cart immediately. He said he could stay in touch with Miss Eastlake via walkie-talkie, I told him it could wait a little. It was important, I said, but not urgent. Not in the 911 sense, at least. And it was true. If Tom were to commit suicide on his cruise, there was little I could do to prevent it. But I didn't think he'd do it as long as his mother and brother were with him. I had no intention of telling Wireman about my furtive hunt through my daughter's purse. That was something of which I'd grown more rather than less ashamed. But once I started, beginning with Link Belt, I couldn't stop. I told him almost everything, finishing with Tom Riley standing at the head of the stairs leading up to Little Pink, pale and dead and minus an eye. I think part of what kept me going was the simple realization that Wireman couldn't commit me to the nearest lunatic asylum. He had no legal authority. Part of it was that, attracted as I was by his kindness and cynical good cheer, he was still a stranger. Sometimes, often I think. Telling stories that are embarrassing or even downright crazy is easier when you're telling them to a stranger. Mostly, though, I pushed on out of pure relief. I felt like a man expressing snake venom from a bite. Wireman poured himself a fresh glass of tea with a hand that was not quite steady. I found that interesting and disquieting. Then he glanced at his watch, which he wore nurse-style with the face on the inside of his wrist. "In half an hour or so, I really have to go up and check on her," he said. "I'm sure she's fine, but what if she wasn't?" I asked. "If she fell or something?" He pulled a walkie-talkie from the pocket of his chinos. It was as slim as a cell phone. "I make sure she always carries hers. There are also rapid-response call buttons all over the house, but—" He tapped a thumb on his chest. "I'm the real alarm system, okay? The only one I trust." He looked out at the water and sighed. "She's got Alzheimer's. It's not too bad yet, but Dr. Hadlock says it'll probably move fast now that it's settled in. A year from now?" He shrugged almost sullenly, then brightened. "We have tea every day at 4. Tea and Oprah. Why not come up and meet the lady of the house? I'll even throw in a slice of key lime pie." "Okay," I said. "It's a deal. Do you think she's the one who left that message on my answering machine about Duma Key not being a lucky place for daughters?" "Sure. Although if you expect an explanation, if you expect her to even remember, good luck. But I can help you a little, maybe. You said something about brothers and sisters yesterday, and I didn't get a chance to correct you. Fact is, all Elizabeth Sibbs were girls. All daughters. The oldest was born in 1908 or thereabouts. Elizabeth came on stage in 1923. Mrs. Eastlake died about 2 months after having her. Some kind of infection. Or maybe she threw a clot. Who's to know at this late date? That was here on Duma Key." "Did the father remarry?" I still couldn't remember his name. Wireman helped me out. "John? No. You're not going to tell me he raised 6 girls out here. That's just too gothic." "He tried with the help of a nanny, but his eldest ran off with a boy. Miss Eastlake had an accident that almost killed her. And the twins..." He shook his head. "They were 2 years older than Elizabeth. In 1927, they disappeared. The presumption is they tried to go swimming, got swept away by an undertow, and drowned out there in the Caldo Grande." We looked at the water for a little while, those deceptively mild waves running up the beach like puppies, and said nothing. Then I asked if Elizabeth had told him all of this. "Some, not all. And she's mixed up about what she does remember. I found a passing mention of an incident that had to be the right one on a website dedicated to Gulf Coast history. Had a little email correspondence with a guy who's a librarian in Tampa." Wireman raised his hands and waggled his fingers in a typing mime. "Tessie and Laura Eastlake. The librarian sent me a copy of the Tampa paper from April 19, 1927. The headline on the front page is very stark, very bleak, very chilling. 3 words. They are gone."
"Jesus," I said.
6 years old. Elizabeth would have been 4. Old enough to understand what had happened. Maybe old enough to read a newspaper headline as simple as, "They are gone." The twins dead and Adriana, the oldest, eloped off to Atlanta with one of his plant managers. No wonder John had had enough of Duma for a while. He and the remaining 3 moved to Miami.
Many years later, he moved back here to die, and Miss Eastlake cared for him.
Wireman shrugged.
Pretty much as I'm caring for her.
So, do you see why an old lady with onset Alzheimer's might consider Duma a bad place for daughters?
I guess so. But how does an old lady with onset Alzheimer's find the phone number of her new tenant?
Wireman gave me a sly look.
New tenant, old number. Auto-dial function on all the phones back there.
He jerked his thumb over his shoulder.
Any other questions?
I gaped at him.
She has me on auto-dial?
Don't blame me. I came in late on this movie show.
My guess is that the realtor who handles things for her programmed the rental properties into the phones.
Or maybe Miss Eastlake's business manager. He pops down from St. Petersburg every 6 weeks or so to make sure she's not dead and I'm not stealing the spode.
I'll ask him the next time he shows up.
So she can call any house on the north end of the quay at the touch of a button.
Well, yeah. I mean, they are all hers.
He patted my hand.
But you know what, muchacho? I think your button is going to have a little nervous breakdown this evening.
No, I said, not even thinking about it. Don't do that.
Ah, Wireman said, exactly as if he understood.
And who knows? Maybe he did.
Anyway, that explains your mystery caller. Although I have to tell you, explanations have a way of thinning out on Duma Key, as your story demonstrates.
What do you mean? Have you had experiences?
He looked at me squarely, his large tanned face inscrutable. The chilly late January wind gusted, blowing sand around our ankles. It also lifted his hair once again, revealing the coin-shaped scar above his right temple. I wondered if someone had poked him with the neck of a bottle, maybe in a bar fight, and tried to imagine someone getting mad at this man. It was hard to do.
Yes, I've had experiences, he said, and hooked the first two fingers of each hand into little quotation marks.
It's what makes children into adults. Also what gives English teachers something to bullshit about in first year of lit courses. Each time with the air quotes.
Okay, he didn't want to talk about it, at least not then.
So I asked him how much of my story he believed.
He rolled his eyes and sat back in his chair.
Don't try my patience, Bato. You might be mistaken about a few things, but you ain't nuts. I got a lady up there, sweetest lady in the world, and I love her. But sometimes she thinks I'm her dad, and it's Miami circa 1934. Sometimes she pops one of her China people into a sweet Owen cookie tin and tosses it into the koi pond behind the tennis court. I have to get him out when she naps, otherwise she pitches a bitch. No idea why. I think by this summer she may be wearing an adult daddy full-time.
Point?
The point is I know Loco. I know Duma, and I'm getting to know you. I'm perfectly willing to believe you had a vision of your friend dead.
No bullshit?
No bullshit, verdad. The question is, what you're going to do about it? Assuming you're not eager to see him in the ground for, may I be vulgar, buttering what used to be your loaf.
I'm not. I did have this momentary thing. I don't know how to describe it.
Was it a momentary thing when you felt like chopping off his dick, then putting out his eyes with a hot toasting fork? Was it that momentary thing, muchacho?
Wireman made the thumb and forefinger of one hand into a gun and pointed it at me.
I was married to a Mexican lassie, and I know jealousy. Both are hot and indigestible. It's normal, like a startle reflex.
Did your wife ever...
I stopped, suddenly aware all over again that I'd only met this man the day before. That was easy to forget. Wireman was intense.
No, amigo, not to my knowledge. What she did was die on me.
His face was perfectly expressionless.
Let's not go there, okay?
Okay. Thing to remember about jealousy is it comes, it goes. Like the afternoon showers down here during the mean season. You're over it, you say. You should be, because you ain't her campesino no more. Question is, what you're going to do about this other thing? How are you going to keep this guy from killing himself? Because you know what happens when the happy family cruise is over, right?
For a moment I said nothing.
I was translating that last bit of Spanish, or trying to. You ain't her farmer no more, was that right? If so, it had a bitter ring of truth. Muchacho, your next move? I don't know, I said. He's got email, but what do I write him? Dear Tom, I'm worried you're contemplating suicide. Please reply soonest. I bet he's not checking his email while he's on vacation anyway. He's got two ex-wives, and still pays alimony to one of them, but he's not close to either. There was one kid, but he died in infancy. Spina bifida, I think. And what? What? Wireman had turned away and sat slouched in his chair, looking out at the water where pelicans were diving for their own high tea. His body English suggested disgust. He turned back. Quit squirming. You know damn well who knows him. Or you think you do. Pam? You mean Pam? He only looked at me. Are you going to talk, Wireman, or only sit there? I have to check on my lady. She'll be up by now, and she's going to want her 4 o'clockies. Pam would think I'm crazy. Hell, she still thinks I'm crazy. Convince her. Then he relented a little. Look, Edgar, if she's been as close to him as you think, she'll have seen the signs. And all you can do is try. ¿Entiendes? I don't understand what that means. It means call your wife. She's my ex. Nope. Until your mind changes, the divorce is just a legal fiction. That's why you give a shit what she thinks about your state of mind. But if you also care about this guy, you'll call her and tell her you have reason to think he's planning to high-side it. He heaved himself out of his chair and then held out his hand. Enough palaver. Come on and meet the boss. You won't be sorry. As bosses go, she's a pretty nice one. I took his hand and let him pull me out of what I presumed was a replacement beach chair. He had a strong grip. That was something else I'll never forget about Jerome Wireman. The man had a strong grip. The boardwalk up to the gate in the back wall was only wide enough for one, so I followed, limping gamely along. When he reached the gate, which was a smaller version of the one in front, and looked as Spanish as Wireman's offhand patois, he turned toward me, smiling a little. Josie comes in to clean Tuesdays and Thursdays, and she's willing to keep an ear out for Miss Eastlake during her afternoon nap, which means I could come down and look at your pictures tomorrow afternoon around 2 if that suits. How did you know I wanted you to? I was still working up the nerve to ask. He shrugged. It's pretty obvious you want someone to look before you show them to the guy at that gallery. Besides your daughter and the kid who runs your errands, that is. The appointment's on Friday. I'm dreading it. Wireman waggled his hand in the air and smiled. Don't worry, he said. He paused. If I think your stuff is crap, I'm going to tell you so. That works. He nodded. Just wanted to be clear. Then he opened the gate and led me into the courtyard of Heron's Roost, also known as Palacio de Asesinos. 2. I'd already seen the courtyard on the day I'd used the front entrance to turn around, but on that day I'd gotten little more than a glance. I'd mostly been concentrating on getting myself and my ashen-faced, perspiring daughter back to Big Pink. I'd noticed the tennis court and the cool blue tiles, but had missed the koi pool entirely. The tennis court was swept and ready for action, its paved surface 2 shades darker than the courtyard tile. One turn of the chrome crank would bring the net taut and ready. A full basket of balls stood on wire stilts and made me think briefly of the sketch Ilsa had taken back to Providence with her, the end of the game. One of these days, muchacho, Wireman said, pointing at the court as we walked by. He had slowed down so I could catch up. You and me. I'll take it easy on you. Just volley and serve. But I hunger to swing a racket. Is volley and serve what you charge for evaluating pictures? He smiled. I have a price, but that ain't it. Tell you later. Come in. 3. Wireman led me through the back door, across a dim kitchen with large white service islands and an enormous Westinghouse stove, then into the whispering interior of the house, which shone with dark woods, oak, walnut, teak, redwood, cypress. This was a palacio, all right. Old Florida style. We passed one book-lined room with an actual suit of armor brooding in the corner. The library connected with a study where paintings, not stodgy oil portraits, but bright, abstract things, even a couple of op-art eye-poppers, hung on the walls. Light showered down on us like white rain as we walked the main hall. Wireman walked, I limped. And I realized that for all the mansion's grandeur, this part of it was no more than a glorified dog trot. The kind that separates sections of older and much humbler Florida dwellings. That style, almost always constructed of wood, sometimes scrap wood, rather than stone, even has a name, Florida Cracker. This dog trot, filled with light courtesy of its long glass ceiling, was lined with planters. At its far end, Wireman hung a right. I followed him into an enormous, cool parlor. A row of windows gave on a side courtyard filled with flowers. My daughters could have named half of them. Pam, all of them. But I could only name the asters, dayflowers, elderberry, and foxglove. Oh, and the rhododendron. There was plenty of that. Beyond the tangle, on a blue-tiled walk that presumably connected with the main courtyard, stalked a sharp-eyed heron. It looked both thoughtful and grim. But I never saw a one on the ground that didn't look like a Puritan elder considering which witch to burn next. In the center of the room was the woman Ilsa and I had seen on the day we tried exploring Dumaquay Road. Then she'd been in a wheelchair, her feet clad in blue high tops. Today she was standing with her hands planted on the grips of a walker, and her feet, large and very pale, were bare. She was dressed in a high-waisted pair of beige slacks and a dark brown silk blouse with amusingly wide shoulders and full sleeves. It was an outfit that made me think of Katharine Hepburn in those old movies they sometimes show on Turner Classic Movies, Adam's Rib or Woman of the Year. Only I couldn't remember Katharine Hepburn looking this old, even when she was old. The room was dominated by a long, low table of the sort my father had had in the cellar for his electric trains. Only this one was covered in some light wood. It looked like bamboo, rather than fake grass. It was crowded with model buildings and china figurines, men, women, children, barnyard animals, zoo animals, creatures of mythical renown. Speaking of mythical creatures, I saw a couple of fellows in blackface that wouldn't have passed muster with the NAACP. Elizabeth Eastlake looked at Wireman with an expression of sweet delight I would have enjoyed drawing. Although I'm not sure anyone would have taken it seriously. I'm not sure we ever believe the simplest emotions in our art, although we see them all around us every day. Wireman, she said. I woke up early, and I've been having such a wonderful time with my chinas. She had a deep southern girl accent that turned chinas into chinas. Look, the family's at home. At one end of the table was a model mansion. The kind with pillars, think Tara in Gone with the Wind, and you'll be fine. Or fine, if you talk like Elizabeth. Around it were ranged almost a dozen figures, standing in a circle. The pose was strangely ceremonial. So they are, Wireman agreed. And the schoolhouse. See how I've put the children outside the schoolhouse? Do come see. I will, but you know I don't like you to get up without me, he said. I didn't feel like calling on that old talkie-walkie. I'm really feeling very well. Come and see. Your new friend as well. Oh, I know who you are. She smiled and crooked a finger at me to come closer. Wireman tells me all about you. You're the new fellow at Salmon Point. He calls it Big Pink, Wireman said. She laughed. It was the cigarette-y kind that dissolves into coughing. Wireman had to hurry forward and steady her. Miss Eastlake didn't seem to mind either the coughing or the steadying.
I like that, she said when she was able. Oh, hon, I like that. Come and see my new schoolhouse arrangement, mister. I'm sure I've been told your name, but it escapes me. So much does now. You are Mr.
Fremantle, I said. Edgar Fremantle. I joined them at her play table. She offered her hand. It wasn't muscular, but was, like her feet, of a good size. She hadn't forgotten the fine art of greeting, and gripped as well as she could. Also, she looked at me with cheerful interest as we shook.
I liked her for her frank admission of memory troubles. And Alzheimer's or not, I did far more mental and verbal stuttering than I'd seen so far from her.
It's good to know you, Edgar. I have seen you before, but I don't recall when. It will come to me.
Big Pink, that's sassy.
I like the house, ma'am.
Good. I'm very glad if it gives satisfaction. It's an artist's house, you know. Are you an artist, Edgar?
She was looking at me with her guileless blue eyes.
Yes, I said.
It was the easiest, the quickest, and maybe it was the truth.
I guess I am.
Of course you are, hon. I knew right away. I'll need one of your pictures. Wireman will strike a price with you. He's a lawyer, as well as an excellent cook. Did he tell you that?
Yes.
No. I mean, I was lost. Her conversation seemed to have developed too many threads, and all at once. Wireman, that dog, looked as if he were struggling not to laugh, which made me feel like laughing, of course.
I try to get pictures from all the artists who have stayed in your Big Pink. I have a herring that was painted there. Also, a dolly sketch.
That stopped any impulse to laugh.
Really? Yes, I'll show you in a bit. One really can't avoid it. It's in the television room, and we always watch Oprah, don't we, Wireman?
Yes, he said, and glanced at the face of his watch on the inside of his wrist.
But we don't have to watch it on the dot, because we have a wonderful gadget called...
She paused, frowned, and put a finger to the dimple in one side of her plump chin.
Veto? Is it Veto, Wireman?
He smiled. TiVo, Miss Eastlake. She laughed.
TiVo. Isn't that a funny word? And isn't it funny how formal we are? He's Wireman to me, and I'm Miss Eastlake to him. Unless I'm upset, as I sometimes am when things slip my mind. We're like characters in a play. A happy one, where one knows that soon the band will strike up and everyone in the company will sing.
She laughed to show what a charming idea it was, but there was something a little frantic in it. For the first time, her accent made me think of Tennessee Williams instead of Margaret Mitchell.
Gently, very gently, Wireman said. Maybe we ought to go into the other room for Oprah now. I think you ought to sit down. You can have a cigarette when you watch Oprah, and you know you like that.
In a minute, Wireman, in just a minute. We have so little company here.
Then back to me.
What kind of artist are you, Edgar? Do you believe in art for art's sake?
Definitely art for art's sake, ma'am.
I'm glad. That's the kind Salmon Point likes best. What do you call it?
My art?
No, hon. Salmon Point.
Big Pink, ma'am.
Big Pink it shall be. And I shall be Elizabeth to you.
I smiled. I had to, because she was earnest rather than flirty. Elizabeth it is.
Lovely. In a moment or two we shall go to the television room, but first...
She turned her attention back to the play table.
Well, Wireman?
Well, Edgar, do you see how I've arranged the children?
There were about a dozen, all facing the left side of the schoolhouse, low student enrollment.
What does it say to you?
She asked.
Wireman? Edward? Either?
That was a very minor slip, but of course I was attuned to slips. The next time my own name was the banana peel.
Recess?
Wireman asked, and shrugged.
Of course not, she said. If it were recess, they'd be playing, not all bunched together and gawking.
It's either a fire or a fire drill, I said. She leaned over her walker. Wireman, vigilant, grabbed her shoulder to keep her from overbalancing, and planted a kiss on my cheek. It surprised the hell out of me, but not in a bad way.
Very good, Edward. Now, which do you say it is?
I thought it over. It was easy if you took the question seriously.
A drill?
Yes.
Her blue eyes blazed with delight.
Tell Wiring why.
If it was a fire, they'd be scattering in all directions. Instead, they're waiting to go back in, yes. But when she turned to Wireman, I saw a different woman. one who was frightened.
I called you by the wrong name again.
It's all right, Miss Eastlake, he said, and kissed the hollow of her temple with a tenderness that made me like him very much. She smiled.